It's a monthly event where people talk about race. It's a different topic every month, and this time there will be excerpts from the anthology. Readers from across the Pacific Northwest will be reading about their experiences of being white, and we will talk also about how white people can get involved in working for racial justice.
And I should mention the event's hosted by People, Places, Things. And KBOO listeners, you could find out more on their Facebook page, People-Places-Things. Teresa, again, thanks a lot. Teresa Bodman.
KBOO for our 25-hour fundraising extravaganza of special programming and community celebration. Tune in at 8 a.m. for Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. Her guest will be retired Seattle City Council member Nick Licata, author of the new book, Becoming a Citizen Activist, Stories, Strategies, and Advice for Changing Our World. Again, that's 6 a.m. on July 14th through 7 a.m. on July 15th to support your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
The responsibility of putting together this material is fully mine. I did it as honestly as I could.
Thursday, July 21st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, as part of the Real Cool Film Series, KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of The Connection.
Do you realize that hardly a day goes by without some item in the daily press concerning narcotics?
In 1962, a movie called The Connection opened in New York, then closed after two showings. However, the soundtrack was released, and jazz fans collected the album of this mysterious movie.
But imagine anyone wanting to use real junkies just to make a movie. Wow.
Again, that's The Connection, Thursday, July 21st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Is it on?
The responsibility of putting together this material is fully mine.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening. This is Second Monday, Labor Radio. On KBOO 90.7. Tonight's host is me, Fernando Gapacin, and Elizabeth Ann McDonald. We have three special guests. Tonight, we have what I believe to be a really relevant show and a vital interest to anybody in the labor movement. We're going to be talking about recent events in Minnesota and Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We're going to be discussing the police killings of Philando Castile and Anton Sterling, and they were number 135 and number 136 black people killed by police in 2016. 2015, there was 306 black people killed by police. Statistically, if you're a black male between the ages of 15 and 34, you are 9 times more likely to be killed by police than any other demographic. They constitute 2% of the population, 15% of the shooting deaths by police. And as a study at University of California points out, they're racially, these killings are racially motivated by the legacy of slavery and white supremacy. Speaking on these issues, we have tonight Teresa Rayford, lead organizer and founder of Don't Shoot Portland, the most active Black Life Matters movement in the Pacific Northwest. We have Bill Fletcher Jr., talk show host, Black and labor activist, author and writer, my co-author of Solidarity Divided, past president of Trans Africa, former education director of the AFL-CIO, and former national organizer for the Black Radical Congress. And we have William Gappasine, a college student of color and activist. Welcome all of you tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill, are you on? Is Bill
on?
Can
you hear me?
Oh, okay. You here?
I'm here.
Okay. So tonight, I guess the general question is, because I just leave it up to folks to talk about, there are two things. One, what must we do to stop these tragedies and to end the killings of Black people by police? And the second part, which is directly related, is how do we deal with the conservative media like Fox News, who is trying to brand our movement, Black Lives Matters, as un-American, perhaps even a terrorist organization, trying to put down or to restrict resistance to these killings. So those are the two points that I'd like folks to address, and anyone can speak out as they choose.
Well, I was going to say, from the perspective of a organizer, one of the things that we have to recognize in America is that the people that are a part of these protests are also union organizers and members and presidents of unions. There are people that have led protests, organized through different organizations before they had to come out and support community engagement. A lot of community members, even here in Portland, when they want to protest, because they know that there's an issue with safety, because we are very aware of police engagement and brutality, and that's what we're protesting against. But they look for leaders in their community that can help them and guide them in the protests so that there's not a lot of issues with being brutalized by police. So we look to unions, we look to strong leaders and organizations to connect with community members that want to use the constitutional right of free speech and freedom to assemble. So when you say that these people are terrorists and that they're organizing against society and government, well, they need to look at the people that are out there on the front line. They are the reflection of the same people that are in our government. They're the same people that elect our government. They're the same people that believe in our Constitution, and that's why they're using it in order to push their message to people that need to develop a consciousness to listen. And so one of our biggest issues is that our leaders are still, like what Dr. King said a long time ago, acquiescent. They are not listening. They feel like there is a filter between them and the people. And if the gatekeepers or whoever their appointed leaders are telling them that they don't have to deal with the measure of sadness or pain that the people are telling them about, they don't have to move. That's how they feel. And so my thing now is that the only way we're going to get past it is by breaking down bureaucracy and changing their outreach within our communities.
Philando Castile, the man who was shot three times for a broken taillight in Minnesota, was an activist in the Teamsters Union.
I think one of the things that I recognize about the two men killed was, as soon as the attacks in Dallas happened, the media coverage was greatly, or could be noticed that the coverage was much different depending on obviously what media outlet you're watching. But I think one thing is the deaths and the murders of black men and black women has become normalized to people as if it's an acceptable thing to happen in everyday, you know, oh, another black guy was killed. You know, you hear that kind of stuff. And I'm from near the Salem area, and you know, it gets worse the farther away you get from a city. Mm-hmm. And so you'll hear things that are almost disgusting and are disgusting regarding the fact that people value the lives of police officers more than they do of black men. And it's not to say that any life is devalued or anything like that. It's to say that there are lives that are being targeted, and to say that that it's okay for black people to be killed and targeted by police is what the focus is. It's not about who's more important. But mm-hmm. as you can see from a lot of media coverage, there is a banner created, for example, for the Dallas killings. And again, not to say that it's okay for those police officers to be killed, but the point was is that as soon as these cops were attacked, it was everybody became concerned. And if that kind of concern can be raised amongst everybody with mm-hmm. these black people and this you know, the African American population being targeted by cops, then I think the situation could be part of the solution if we could get that much interest behind it.
Bill?
You know, Fernando, one of the things that I think is important for your listeners to keep in mind is that any time an oppressed group emerges and fights back, it becomes demonized. And so, for example, unions were illegal in the United States for, more than 100 years. Union activists were jailed for the simple fact that they were organizing workers to respond to economic injustice. In the 1950s, the NAACP was banned by the state of Alabama. Banned. I mean, we're not talking about a revolutionary organization. NAACP. And during the 1960s and 70s, we had many examples where groups, activist groups, were demonized, were called everything but children of God by the other side. So there's nothing new under the sun here. Part of what I would say, though, to the right wing, when they start saying, well, Black Lives Matter is behind this violence, I would ask, well, who was behind Timothy McVeigh? Mm-hmm. Right? Who was behind the KKK? I mean, if you really want to play that game, let's play it. Because, see, we have all the cards. Right? So let's ask, who was behind Timothy McVeigh? And don't tell me he was just some poor, misunderstood white boy. Right? Let us talk about what that was all about. And let's move away from this ridiculousness of trying to smear the Black Lives Matter. As the sister was saying, I mean, we're dealing with thousands of activists from different organizations, not just one organization, different organizations who have been practicing nonviolent protests. So the fact that this deranged individual decided to go after the cops, to hold the movement responsible for that, is just simply absurd.
Teresa?
I mean, I agree. I definitely agree. And it's not safe for us. I'm hoping that in the continued protest, that because we have recognized that Philandro Castile was a Teamster, I hope that's not the only reason that we rebuild in our unity. Because one of the things that happened here locally is immediately after our protest last Thursday, the mayor, who is also our police commissioner, had a press conference outside City Hall. Now, even in relativity to what happened with us, with someone coming out and pulling a gun out, they didn't have the consideration to contact leaders of our organization and even invite us to the press conference. And then the conference consisted of them basically stating that we are the ones that are making things worse in our community because we're not working with law enforcement against black-on-black crime. Now, that's a sick message to give to a community that has suffered to the point of humiliating themselves and putting their lives on the front line to get an answer from our legal and our appointed leaders. For our church congregations to stand there with the political leaders that have the power and the resources to identify and change policy and to put it again back onto the community that is most vulnerable to the system and the circumstance, it's just outrageous. And they did it under the hashtag of Dallas. This was supposed to be their appropriate response to the protests and what happened in Dallas. And it was just a clear... It was just, in my opinion, for the work that our community does and for all the children who had never protested before, for them to get their passion and pain out in those streets the night before and then be criminalized or demonized by our leaders, it was a slap in the face. I had families calling saying, "What is this?" My kids felt good about going out there. My mom was out there. We were sad before we got out there with you guys. And we got home safe and everybody was safe and they respected the leadership. But our leadership didn't even show that they could be considerate enough to see if we were all safe or even to commend us on how we de-escalated what could have been a very harmful situation for our community.
You know, one other thing that I want to throw in here, Fernando, is that would the larger population, the white population, find it acceptable if the police went into Italian-American neighborhoods and started shooting up the kids? Because of the mafia, right? Because of organized crime. Would that be considered acceptable to basically pull people aside and if they see a gun, shoot them, right? Would that be acceptable? And you know, and I know it would simply not be acceptable. And just the same way that you have this demonization of African Americans, you have this demonization of Mexicans and Chicanos, that's being perpetrated, including and most especially recently by Trump, claiming that Mexicans are the sources of crime. And so this demonization is turning populations into the other, into something that's less than human. It permits a climate where individuals feel like it is simply okay to shoot and kill.
I was reading the Black Lives Matters website, and it was a really insightful comment made by Patrice Cullors, one of the founders of Black Lives Matters. And she was talking about how this form of oppression comes from someplace, comes historically. And she pointed out how, at least in the South, police structures, police training, police orientation, police culture was all geared towards oppression of slaves. And that those attitudes permeate a place. It's like a place that we live near, where all the symbols are dragons. And you know where those dragons came from. And the thing is that the notions of the Klan, the notion of black oppression are embedded in the structures of these communities within their law enforcement systems. How do we unwrap that crap?
Well, in part, it's going to depend on who actually occupies political power. Because one of the things that needs to happen is that you have to have political leadership that essentially says, this is unacceptable. And within our police department, we're going to hire the right people. We're going to have a different kind of relationship with the community. We will have civilian oversight of these activities. So political leadership can change the entire framework and interaction. I mean, you have countries around the world that have police that do not carry guns. I mean, so the idea that you have to carry a gun is very specific to the United States. And so I think that this issue of who has political leadership, who exerts that becomes critically important, which is one of the reasons that opposing police violence and police lynchings is not simply about protests, but it's about a strategy of gaining power.
Well, that actually reminds me of something me and my dad were talking about on the way up here. And it was, what I was trying to understand the other side. And as any other kind of argument or debate or understanding a situation, you should try and get a hold of the other side. And I was trying to understand the perspective of those opposing Black Lives Matter, the movement. And so I asked my dad, I said, you know, if let's for a moment humor what they're saying and say that maybe, you know, yeah, okay, they're right, where it's all equal or whatever it is, right? And so what would be the purpose of the fight, you know, if there was no real inequality, you know, Black men and women aren't being targeted by police, then what would be the objective? And essentially after a little bit of conversation, it came down to the fact that it's just to squander or fight the resistance of a group that's being demonized, because that is the point. As what Bill said, is if we gain enough ground, gain enough power, we can change the system, and then that then changes the dynamic that you know, of how society would work, and that creates a problem. And so, yeah, I think that was a great point.
And I was going to say that one of the things that we do, I posted something the other day, and I was letting people know that when we go out and protest, I know Minister Farrakhan held a march a couple of months ago, and people from Ferguson had went there and were saying justice or else, you know. And so when we do our protest, that's the or else, that's the exclamation point. That means that for 364 days before we had to do that one protest, or for 10 days before we had to do that weekly protest or whatever, that we've made some type of work towards legislation, policy. We're working with activists and advocates with the ACLU, the Portland Law Collective. I just was at the ACLU talking to their legislative director, Kimberly McCullough, asking, what is your legislative focus for the rest of this year? How can we work with people in our community to understand the directives towards the work that you're doing to evaluate or to create value for our civil liberties? Because a lot of the work that we're doing when we go out and protest, we're already working within the system to change policy. And the protest is to acknowledge to the community that we are out here, that our voices do matter, and that there's work being done. It's not the rage that people propagate it to be on the media, like, look at them, where are they out there? They're going to have to do something besides protest. And you guys can't just protest. Nobody just protests. I don't know too many organizers or community leaders or activists that are only protesting. And people like ourselves who are on this call and on the radio, we know that. Because, you know, we get the time when radio or media needs somebody that's relative to the movement, they don't just call you because they saw you protesting. They'll know that you're working directly with the people that have the power, and you're working directly with the community. So we call it first responder. We call ourselves community advocates. But the work doesn't stop, and it doesn't begin at the protest. That's just when the rest of the community acknowledges that something's happening, because a lot of people are asleep.
Where you're listening to Second Monday Labor Radio on KBOO 90.7 Portland, Oregon. Tonight we're discussing Black Lives Matters and building the movement to stop the attacks on Black people. We were commenting on the notion of building political power, and I've heard this referred to as building communities of solidarity, where people take responsibility for their humanity, essentially, and where people take responsibility for the welfare of others. I've heard it called building political blocks. There's been notions spread about how this can occur and how we can build actual political power where we actually change society. We've seen the movement on the right rebuild itself around opposition to anything that's progressive. Are there models, perhaps examples, of how people are taking power?
Well, before people take power, there needs to be an educational process at the rank and file of every social movement that really helps to disentangle race so that folks understand what exactly race is about. And race is about oppression and social control. Race has been the most successful means of enlisting one segment of the population against both itself and against another. And so when we're talking about, for example, racial violence and what the police are doing, this is not just about what the police are doing to African Americans or to Latinos. It's also about the willingness of a segment of the white population to sit back and either remain silent or to actively support this kind of repression, none of which actually ends up helping them, but in which they end up feeling that they're on the side of the righteous. And so part of what we have to do in our labor unions, for example, is engage members in a discussion about race. How does race work? Why was it constructed in the first place? You know, when the colonies were formed here, what is this all about? These are the kinds of things that must be undertaken if people are to fight for power. Because when we choose not to have these discussions, when we think, let's not talk about race, let's talk about other things that we agree on, when inevitably race raises its head, movements are not prepared to deal with it. So if we want to succeed, we have to put it on the table.
Well, I really agree on that. And the thing is that we don't do one without the other. It's in addition to, because this is a issue that we built this country on this issue. This is our biggest commoditization that we have, whether it be in federalism or whether it be in corporate business, whether it's on Wall Street. Poverty is a commodity. And having race attached to it and having policing measures and all these social systems that are a part of it, that's a big giant construct to dismantle. But my thought is this, one of the reasons that I organize with so many youth is that I feel like there's a generation that has control of our austerity as a government. And a lot of them want to say, this is how our forefathers, this is how they built it. And I don't think that anybody with a reasonable business sense or even a social system sense or even a political sense would expect anyone in today, in 2016, to live and abide by all of the rules and constraints that were acknowledged and built into the corporation of America. It was built to commoditize poverty and the disenfranchised. They knew that they were going to use forced labor to do this. They knew that at the time that they were brutalizing people through rape and just all different types of ways. So they knew that they were building a business that was going to have terrorism attached to it. And in order to terrorize, you have to find out who is going to be the assault victim in this. Who are we going to utilize that no one else would value? And it was people of color. You know, we came over here and we did that. And with that type of established business, you have to dismantle the whole thing. A lot of people don't agree with me when I say that things cannot be reformed. I don't believe that fixing a system that works that accurately based on the initial business product line or whatever you want to call it, the business corporation of America, it's not going to work that way. You have to go in there wanting to dismantle. You got to go in there. And when you say break systems, that means change policy immediately and directly. We don't have to wait for bureaucracy. As protesters, we were able to shut down House bills within 24 hours because we went to the state capitol with a clear and cohesive message of what was happening that we felt was going to violate our civil liberties. We need leaders to stand up and have that same courage, because if they're right there, they can say, I'm not taking no for an answer. They need to protest more, and not just when they're doing the sit-ins to promote political agendas, but when they're sitting in to save lives. And I'm not talking about the corporate lobbying lives and the funding that needs to happen with messaging. I'm talking about every single day individuals that are affected on both sides of the table of these issues. We don't get to pick a side. We're dying.
As from UC Golden School of Public Policy, Jack Glaser said that race is the trigger for police brutality. And I want to highlight how if we could get the media to put on the front page, if we could create those movements where we can highlight how police brutality is directly related to the ideology of slavery and white supremacy. The thing is that we can create a movement, we can create that political power to break the back of the attacks on black people. And this is, it's important. Black lives matter. And it's a racial attack grounded in the history of this nation. And we have to undo that history.
That's right. I think another important point that was discussed a little bit ago was the common uncomfortableness with race. Especially, you know, I live in an area where there's a lot of white people, and so I my friends, my closest friends are white, and just discussing and, like, you know, breaking down ideas and discussing those kinds of just discussing race, it can be incredibly helpful in expanding the, you know, the open-mindedness that has been and fighting that closed-mindedness that's been conditioned in some places by the United States was founded off of slavery, and so there's a lot of things that are conditioned into people that, I mean, conditioned ignorance in a way. Mm-hmm. And so to climb that ladder, to, like Teresa was saying about the youth being a tool that is very, very valuable in terms of breaking down that system and changing, is understanding. Is this just simple understanding of people who kind of take things for granted or maybe don't understand the importance of race?
Teresa, do you want to make some closing remarks?
Well, I just want to encourage our youth and all of our communities, and especially like the AFL-CIO Teamsters. They've been with us on the front line since we were doing all of the Ferguson-related protests and continuously. And I noticed that they moved away from the front line after legislative session. I'm hoping that this issue shows them that they don't have that luxury. And I hope that they come out and they step with us on Wednesday, 3:00 at Dawson Park, because in lieu of what happened downtown last Thursday, it's even more important that we have all of our comrades and allies out there with us, because we don't know what to expect, but we know that we can't let fear be a factor in stopping us from using our constitutional rights to protest police brutality.
I want to thank Teresa, Bill,